Like to bring this meeting of House Education together. Like to remind everybody about their cell phones. And this morning we have Representative Book, Representative Gardner, Representative Wilson, Chair Seaton. And today we have three bills that we're going to be considering. House Bill 295, the University Land Grant Bill. House Bill 317, which is Education Funding Bill, and House Bill 206, High School Assessments. And the intention is to get amendments brought forward, to have these in there, make sure the final bills are posted on our website, and then we'll be looking at moving those bills next week while we give the public school districts, anybody that's interested, an opportunity to comment on the, as we construct it, at least at this time, the final construction of those bills. Is there anything come before the committee before we get started? Okay, we will take up the University Land Grant Bill, and you have before you on the table a couple of other handouts, information on the federal land grant, history of the University of Alaska, and from DNR on the Historic Preservation Act. So, just so everybody knows that they have on the table there. Let's see, and we do have Mr. Milius from DNR here to answer questions. And we kept the public record open, so we will go to public hearing now. And we have signed up, we have three people signed up here that I have at this point just for answering questions. I'll read their names, and if they're actually wanting to testify, would you please let me know. Marty Parsons, Mary Montgomery, and Wendy Redman. We have those people on, but I have it noted as questions. So if you want to offer testimony, make sure you let us know. We have Deb Spencer. Are you in the audience online? Is Deb Spencer online?
Yes, I'm online, sir.
Oh, good morning. Would you identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, thank you, Chair Seaton. My name is Deb Spencer. I'm calling in from Pelican, Alaska, and I'm the owner of Shoreline Incorporated. I was able to testify last week, and I submitted some follow-up comments to the committee dated February 2nd. So I would just like to briefly follow up on those comments and not reiterate everything I've already commented on.
And Ms. Spencer, just to let you know, we do have in our packets your February 2nd letter.
Thank you kindly, Chair. Okay, first of all, I guess I would like to suggest that possibly the source of some of the comments that you're hearing and the consternation from the public about these particular parcels is due to the fact that there was a public process to identify these lands, and that public process, you know, took place, we all participated, and now the land use designations are not being respected as a result of these university land selections. The area plans were, the northern southeast area plan was intended to be put in place for 20 years. It was dated 2002, so that should be good for another 10 years. And it was the result of years of work with the public and communities and stakeholders. By contrast, the letters, both letters of commendation by Commissioner Irwin accompanying initially HB 130 and now HB 295 state that they were the work of the result, the land selections were the result of work between DNR and the university. There is no mention of any public process. So that is troubling to all of us. And so I would like to just point out, if you have in front of you the land grant list from 2010, the parcel descriptions, That's a 15-page document, and I'd like to point out that I'm talking particularly again about the Mite Cove parcel. On page 9 of 15 in that document...
In just a moment, let me make sure that the committee has what we're talking about. Is that a... we have one that's a chart or a table...
Yes, it's a 15-page table. It's entitled University of Alaska Land Grant List 2010 Parcel Descriptions.
Okay, just a minute. Let us make sure that we get the tabs, maybe in the book. Parcel Descriptions, University of Alaska. Okay, and for the committee, there is a tab in your book. It's one of the bottom tabs there. It says Parcel Descriptions. I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page here. And which page are you talking about?
First, I'd like to go to page 9. Okay.
Okay, we have page 9.
Okay, and the Mite Cove parcel there that is described as 320 acres?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. First of all, the 320 number doesn't correspond with the area plan. The area plan states that this parcel is 180 acres, and you will see in the text just to the right of the 320 that it says this parcel occupies nearly 200 acres. So the document itself is in conflict with itself. I'd like to point out, too, that the text that's in straight up and down text is just a description, but the very last sentence there that says considered appropriate for remote residential or commercial recreation marine services, that doesn't correspond with the land use designation in the plan that designates this land is RU, public recreation and tourism, undeveloped. So that description, I don't know where that came from, but it certainly doesn't come from any plan that was part of any public process. And then if you could quickly turn to page 11 of the same document, to the Thumb Dumb parcel.
Okay, then. Just a moment. Yes, we have it down here.
Okay, and
if you look at page 11 for the committee,
in the lower right, in the right-hand column there, in the description, it says public recreation dispersed in italics. That's meant to be a reference to the plan designation, but that plan designation doesn't exist in the plan. In the plan, it's actually that parcel is. Designated the same as the Mite Cove parcel, recreation and tourism, undeveloped. And in the plan, that language states that that those lands cannot be sold to individuals. That's directly from the plan. And so that's why I would suggest that these two parcels you keep hearing about keep coming to the surface, because these lands were not intended to be turned over to any individual, that they were meant to be held in the public. And so I guess my point is that it seems like, you know, some of these errors, and these are the two parcels I've just looked at, and some of the errors are a little bit glaring in my opinion, and maybe indicate some haste in developing this list. But also, I guess I would just like to conclude by saying that the City of Pelican passed a resolution in 2005 opposing this same legislation, and the city has on its agenda for Tuesday's meeting consideration of a similar piece of a similar resolution. And so I think that that's all I have for you right now. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Okay, thank you. And just for the committee's note, in her letter of February 2nd, on the second page, is the testimony about the lands cannot be sold to individuals and the description of that RU, public recreation, tourism, undeveloped.
Thank you.
Are there questions from the committee? Okay, I would like to thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Spencer. And rather than going down the list and just selecting people, I would like to ask if there's anyone else that has specific testimony on either Mite Cove or Sumdum. Okay, would you come forward?
Am I coming through?
Yes, you are. Would you identify yourself so I can find you on the sheet here, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, yes. My name is Tim Lydon. My wife, Barbara Lydon, is also on the line. We're residents of Juneau.
Thank you very much. I have you on the sheet here. Go ahead with your testimony, Mr. Lydon.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. And I'd also like to say it's my wife, Barbara, and I, but after testifying for us, I also have a statement to read from 17 Southeast Alaska tour operators. Is that okay?
Yes, that'd be fine, but we would like you to mail or fax that in to us as well.
Okay, no problem. And the testimony relates to Sumdum, the Sumdum parcel, the five-acre parcel in Endicott Arm. Like many others who have testified, I support the university. Frankly, I'm not sure what the best way to fund the university is, but I certainly appreciate the university. My concern about Sumdum, our concern, is its location in Endicott Arm. It's squarely in the middle of the Tracy Arm, Fords Terror, and Chuck River Wilderness Complex. Those are designated wilderness areas on the Tongass National Forest. And as far as Tracy Arm and Endicott Arm, the Sumdum parcel, or I'm sorry, Tracy Arm and Endicott Arm, that area there, there's no development in there whatsoever right now, which makes it a pretty unique place for wildlife and also for tourism, recreation, and all kinds of other wilderness-related values. And I think that it is an inappropriate parcel to develop because it's relied upon by so many people for a wide variety of things like bird watching, kayaking, walking. There's nice salmon streams there. It's a safe anchorage. It's a safe camp. The weather can pick up pretty good. Endicott Arm, so it's a, if you look at Endicott Arm, there really are not, if you look at Tracy Arm and Endicott Arm together, there are hardly any places where you can anchor a boat or duck in out of the wind or have a place that's not sheer for camping, not sheer walls, I mean, and that Sanford Cove area where the Sumdum parcel is fits all of those descriptions, so it's really unique in that area. Let's see. There's two anadromous fish streams, I think, on either side of the parcel, and one of them might be on the parcel, but either way, it's highly valued for salmon, bears, wolves. There's really a unique amount of bird life that gathers in that area, both in the spring and later on in the summer for the salmon, and then later on again, too, in the fall. And privatizing that parcel, putting a lodge there like that could have an effect on not only all that wildlife, but that go there to enjoy it. And then Tracy Arm and Endicott Arm become pretty popular places for large ships and small ships, that kind of thing, but it's maintained its remoteness, and one of the reasons there is no development down there. There's no float plane dock, there's no dock for boats like Allen Marine boats, whatever, that might do daily tours. And myself and others really fear that by privatizing this, you're not going to affect just one isolated five-acre parcel. You're really going to have a dramatic effect on both Tracy and Endicott Arms. And I really want to stress that although they're 50 miles from Juneau, if you go up and down Stevens Passage, there are not very many places that are undeveloped where people can duck in and have kind of a private experience like that. So my wife and I, Barbara, are really opposed to developing that, and we hope that that parcel can be taken out of the landfill. And I suppose that really wraps up what I wanted to say. And then, if it's okay by you, I'll read. I have a statement here, and I can read the 17 companies that it's from. Or how would you like me to do that?
I think that if you would just fax that in to us, that would be helpful. And we'll put that in. We understand the testimony, but it would be good to have it in our records. And so we've got three bills before us today, so I don't want to take too long on a, I think we understand the gist of the, of what you're going to read.
Actually, it comes from a different perspective because it really comes from a very commercial perspective, whereas mine's more personal, and I don't have to read the names of the companies if that saves time. However, it is only, I think, three short paragraphs, if you wouldn't mind.
You can go ahead and put that in, and then just send it in, and we'll have the names.
Okay, so are you saying not to read it then?
No, you can go ahead if they're short.
Okay, yeah, it's short. So this is 17 undersigned small and mid-sized tour operators that operate in Southeast Alaska. They bring thousands of visitors to Southeast Alaska every year. Our businesses provide guided hunting and fishing, kayak expeditions, and week-long excursions aboard small and mid-sized vessels. Our segment of Alaska's tourism industry provides vital and unique economic benefits to Southeast Alaska, and many of us are local business people. We stand out among other segments of the tourism industry because many of us provision our excursions locally, and a high number of our clients dine and seek local accommodations before and after their trips. University of Alaska research shows businesses like ours, small and mid-sized tour operators, pump millions of dollars into Southeast Alaska's economy annually. Bringing clients to wild Alaskan landscapes is the backbone of our business, and it's the reason for our concern over the Sumdum Parcel. The Sumdum Parcel is in Sanford Cove in the heart of the Tracy Arm, Fort Terre, and Chuck River wilderness areas. For each of us, the area is a highlight of the services we provide. Many of us use Sanford Cove as a safe and scenic anchorage. With bears, wolves, salmon, and cultural ruins, it is a common location for walks ashore, fishing, hunting, and camping, not only for our commercial clients, but for many independent and local travelers, too. Tracy Arm, Fort Terre Wilderness is especially unique because it currently contains no lodges, private cabins, or other developments. Some of us have operated in Southeast Alaska for several decades, long enough to know that such undeveloped anchorages are increasingly rare. I'm almost done. Privatization of the Sumdum Parcel would displace many of us from long-standing business activities. It would also displace many independent and local recreationists and mar an undeveloped landscape. But removing the Sanford Cove Parcel from the bill would have only minor impact on university funding, one that could be compensated by other means. And the group just thanks you for your consideration, and that's their statement. And I can fax it to you, but I don't have a fax number. Do I get that on hold or something?
Yeah. We're trying to think what it is right now. It is 465-3472. And if anyone else out there has written testimony that they'd like to fax in, please do so.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Was there anyone else that hasn't testified that wants to testify on either Mite Cove or Sundom? Yes. Please come forward.
Good morning. My name is Mary Irvin. I'm a resident of Juneau. I live at 326 6th Street, and my phone number is 586-1480. I did come before you last week, and so I'm not going to repeat that testimony, but some questions came up after my testimony, and the questions had to do with the sort of multi-layered cultural nature of the Sumdum Parcel. And I would like to hear whether there was an answer to Representative Gardner's question about, or actually I think it was Representative Munoz's question about whether DNR could come forth with more documentation on the archaeological nature of the site. I would like to say that as a private individual, I am at a little bit of a disadvantage because legislators and people who are higher up in state agencies have the ability to receive from the Office of History and Archaeology in Anchorage documentation of a confidential nature about the archaeological nature of sites, which is not usually given to the likes of me for good reasons. I wanted to simply ask that that be pursued. I do happen to know that there are documents on file at OHA. But I wanted to also bring your attention to some publicly available information about the multicultural layered nature of the Sumdum site. And one published report is in the 1946 Goldschmidt and Haas anthropological report that they did around Southeast Alaska. They have maps in the back of this book, which is called Ha'ani, and it is in reprint by the Sea Alaska Corporation. So that it does speak to the first level of the site at Sumdum. But as other people have said, that's not the entire nature of the cultural ness of the site. There is the later historic nature of the site, which is the mining town at Sumdum. And it was right on the parcel at Sumdum that we're discussing that the mining town grew up. 1879 was the year that the Presbyterian missionary Samuel Hall Young was there. And later, the USGS survey, as they were mapping Southeast Alaska for the United States government, stopped there. I just wanted to reiterate that it is a multi-layered cultural site and not just Native history. While I want to be very reverential towards the Native cultural history there, it's not necessarily a sacred site for the Tlingit people. It was an old fish camp. It's a special site. It's not necessarily a sacred site, although there may be artifacts in the ground there that should be covered by various laws, including the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Law of 1990. So that's all I have, and I'd like to entertain any questions about the site at Sumdum. Thank you very much for considering it.
Thank you. And Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you very much. Is there any remains of that town at all there now?
And through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's a great question. And I don't know. Like I say, I've never seen the confidential documents on file at the Office of History and Archaeology. What I do know is there's a fun little site online called Vilda, and what it is our historical library, the State Historical Library, has taken upon itself scanning in to the internet historical photos around all of Alaska. And so I'm sorry I didn't bring any with me today, but if you go on to the Vilda website, V-I-L-D-A, and type in Sumdum, you'll see pictures of the old town site. There's cabins there, log cabins there. I'd really love for there to be a picture of the old brewery there, but there's not a picture of that. But there is a picture of an ore cart that the men, six men to an ore cart, would get into in the morning and ride the corduroy road. They actually lay down railroad tracks, and they would horse draw these carriages or these carts, these ore carts, down into the tunnels at Sumdum, south of the Sumdum parcel, into the hills there. It's hard rock gold mining, so they tunnel into the mountains. And I'm not sure I've been able to identify the gentleman, but I think it was one of the people who bankrolled the mine down at Sumdum, either the Sumdum Chief Mine or the Eagle Mine, and he's standing there in a three-piece suit, you know, in front of one of these ore carts on the corduroy road, you know. And so these pictures are available, really speaking to the multi-layered nature of that site. And you know, I personally have not been down there. I'm not an artifact hunter, you know, and I wouldn't encourage that, but I would encourage the excising of the 5-acre parcel at Sumdum from this university lands bill.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
And rather than get off on other sites, Mr. Milius, would you come forward so we can And this bill, for the public to know, has several committees of referral. It'll go to resources and others so that there are other opportunities to talk on this issue. Yes. Mr. Milius. We've heard a couple of things here, and I'm just trying to figure out on some dumb in the book where we have this disparity between what the public recreation tourism undeveloped designation and this dispersed. Do you have any information on for us on the dichotomy of those two things?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dick Milius. I'm the director.
You don't have to talk quite so loud or be quite so close to the mic there for us.
For the record, my name is Dick Milius. I'm the director of DNR Division of Mining, Land, and Water. And yes, after last week's hearing, I went back and talked to the folks that actually worked on the land lists. And one of the things that I didn't bring up when I was explaining what parcels we used was that one of the criteria they used was lands that the plans identified for land sales or for development. And the one that I didn't mention was they also looked at lands that municipalities could acquire under the Municipal Entitlement Act, because the what types of lands municipalities can select is actually laid out in statutes. It's Alaska Statutes 2965. And there's a category of what's called vacant, unappropriate, unreserved lands that's defined in the definitions, and it's defined based on the land classifications. And one of the classifications is public recreation. So when we put the list together, we felt that if the legislature had said it's appropriate to transfer public recreation lands to municipalities, that it would be appropriate to transfer those public recreation lands to the university as well. So that was how things like the Mite Cove parcel and Sumdum parcel got in there, because, like I say, they could be selected by municipalities, so they could leave state ownership under that. So that was one of the considerations in putting the list together. So that's why you do see things like Mite Cove on the list.
Thank you. That's helpful. But my specific question is on Sumdum, I think, where it's listed in our book on page 11 as dispersed, and we have it listed in these others at, coming from the tourism, or I mean from the plan. Southeast plan as recreational and tourism undeveloped, which is and I'm not sure about this dispersed public recreation, and then it says after that dispersed versus the category, my understanding from the plan is public recreation and tourism undeveloped.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of the actual land classification that gets applied to those, it's the same classification. It's that public recreation classification. So that's why we considered that one as appropriate for transfer, that it, even though it says it's dispersed recreation and tourism, it still ends up as classified as public recreation when you actually put the land classification on it.
Okay. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Can you speak to any public process during the selection?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, we didn't have a public process in the selection because we were basing it, like I say, off of decisions made in land use plans that did go through a public process. And then the public process was actually the legislative process, which was in 2005 extensive. As I know, Representative Wilson was involved in a lot of those hearings, and we had numerous hearings in the House and Senate, and the public weighed in, so there was a lot of public input into the list through the legislature.
Representative Gardner, follow up.
As I recall, at that time when the list was presented to the legislature, the governor's stated desire was that it be accepted as is with no changes. So I could see how small communities who may or may not have been successful in their own efforts would have felt a little bit up against the wall and not having had an opportunity to participate in the selection process. It's a lot easier to change something once a decision's been made than to be consulted at the outset.
Representative Gardner, the legislature did, as through the process, take out 9 parcels because of all the public input. And part of it was one of the reasons why we did it that way was the original legislation, Senate Bill 7 in 2000, essentially put that all on DNR and the university to essentially slug out the process, and we knew it would be contentious, and So we felt it was more appropriate if the legislature really wanted to give the university lands was to essentially the university to try to, or the legislature to try to address some of those public concerns, because almost every single one parcel here, you're going to get hear public concerns about. You know, you're hearing now about the Pelican parcels, the Sumdum. Mm-hmm. You know, at some other hearing, I'm sure the legislature is going to hear about the McCarthy parcels. There's very few parcels of state land that people would like to see. Everybody, one of our challenges at DNR is that there's a lot of public support and legislative support for like land sales and land disposals. But as soon as you propose to transfer a chunk of state land out of state ownership to anybody, the local community almost without exception raises its concerns, unless it's some parcel that's way out, not near where anybody is, and then it's of very little value to the university. But essentially any of our high value parcels of land, you're going to find somebody who's going to object to it. So it's not an easy process. And so I think part of it, the feeling was that, you know, the legislature should try to address some of those concerns.
Thank you. So basically, the people that want to support the university and want some land development just don't want it their land. Thank you.
And that was not a question for you. just to make it clear. Representative Wilson?
I have a couple of questions. One question is the Mite Cove parcel. If it was to be transferred over to the university, would it still be under the same? Will it still be under public recreation and tourism undeveloped? What can the university do with that?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, once it's transferred to the university, it is not subject to the area plan designations anymore. The university can do as it sees appropriate with those lands. And the university has folks online if you actually wanted to get any input directly from them.
And we'll go to the university in just a moment. Okay. So
my problem is across the state of Alaska. First of all, the state doesn't own very much land, you know, and so there's not a whole lot of little places all across the state. However, there's a lot less in Southeast because it's mostly federal land. It's mostly Tongass Forest. And so these little pieces of land that are available to the public are pretty precious in Southeast compared to maybe in another area where it was a lot more available. And is there any possibility that we could look at this and realize that the many tourism opportunities that are in Southeast, if there's development on some of those areas, that the tourism advantage that we have down here would diminish?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. Well, to begin with, you're correct that there was very little state land in Southeast, but the state land selections in Southeast were actually made under the Statehood Act primarily for community development or community recreation. So that was kind of the purpose of them, was largely for development. It was because recognizing that the National Forest was never going to be developed, for example, for commercial recreation or for people to live on and stuff, the lands the state actually acquired in Southeast by their very intent were lands that were supposed to be put into either development or recreation, and some of them put into state parks and such. So the very nature of the lands that we have in Southeast tends to make them suitable for recreational development or private ownership, either one, because they tend to be around good coves and stuff. And obviously there's a conflict there, but those are, whether you're looking at land for development or for recreation, the places in Southeast you go to are those places that have protected anchorages and some flat developable land. So
I think that we all need to recognize we have several opposing good things. One is that Southeast doesn't want to lose population, but if Southeast doesn't have private development or places where people can live, expand that, then there's less opportunity. There is the value of having lands undeveloped so that people can come and see them. And and all those are good values, and our legislative process is going to have to determine what we think should go forward. We also, as the Education Committee, we hear on a number of problems of small schools and worrying about losing population, losing schools, in fact, and yet if we're in the situation where we say we don't want to have any additional houses because we came for the way things were, and then we closed schools. So the question is I mean, I'm just laying this out that there are good options and good reasons for doing both things, and it's this committee's and the legislature's responsibility on these parcels to figure out what we want to do with each one and what balance we want to achieve. So I just want to make sure that we don't give the public the intention, the impression that the state is the bad guy for wanting to get parcels in private hands, because one of the biggest things with her is there's not enough private lands for development, and so with competing interests. And Representative Wilson.
And I guess where I'm coming from, if, for instance, this Mike Cove area, because this land was set aside for communities, I don't feel that it's probably right for us to give it to a university when, like this Mike Cove one, Pelicans hoping that it can be developed, but they would rather, I mean, because it's close to the town and that there could be development and the town could benefit, but they would rather that they would take the university would take other land that's further away, you know, so that you know, there's no guarantee of what the university will do and or how soon it can be done, but this is a parcel that could be of benefit to the town itself, close enough that people aren't going to go out, you know, when you're in a town already and there's population, well, you usually go to the further away areas to take people, to show them the tourism stuff. But I just kind of have a question whether we should be, as a legislature, taking land that was supposed to be set aside for communities, because the university is not a community as far as the people living in Southeast are concerned.
And Mr. Miles, have these communities already decided that they had certain areas they could select, and these are parcels that communities did not select, and they selected alternative parcels, or are those communities not formed so that they had the ability to select lands?
Representative Seaton, it depends on the parcel and the community. In the case of the Pelican city limits are very small, and they got, I think, a small amount of land from the state, but their entitlement's fulfilled, and Mite Cove is well outside of their boundaries, so they did not have the ability to select land there, and they didn't have an entitlement. There was in the past some discussion of a borough formation in that part of Southeast. I don't think there's any active pursuing of that. In Wrangell, you've got the different situation where they actually have formed a borough. They do have a municipal entitlement, and so they actually have the ability to select some of these. So they're in a different category. When you get down to some of the parcels that are in Ketchikan Gateway Borough, they've already had their municipal entitlement determined, and they've selected all their lands and received their lands, so they have no more remaining entitlements. So the parcels that are actually in the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, the borough sections is a non-issue because that's already been taken care of. So you've got those three different categories of okay. things that are no borough and no entitlement currently, borough still working on it. The only one of those is Wrangell, and then Ketchikan, an entitlement already fulfilled. Excuse me.
Thank you. Representative Gardner, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. And thinking about your comments, Mr. Chair, about how there are competing values, and no matter what you do, somebody's not going to be happy, and somebody, you know, there's winners and losers in the end. One of the things that makes people accept a decision they don't like is if they feel they've been heard and their concerns actually were listened to, even if the result wasn't what they wanted. And so I'm just a little fixated on the public process, and I want to make sure I understand what you said. Is there's a public process to come up with land use plans and classifications, and then those plans and classifications were the basis of the selections that were made by the state and the university for the university lands. But then, and then there was a public process through the legislative process where people could also weigh in, and some changes came through that. But then you said once the land is transferred to the university, it's no longer subject to the land use plan. Is that correct? Okay. Thank you. Just want to make sure I understood.
Okay, thank you. And Wendy Redman, are you online?
Yes, I am, sir.
Thank you. Would you identify yourself for the record, and then we'll have some questions for you, I think.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Wendy Redman. I'm the Executive Vice President for the Statewide University of Alaska System.
Thank you, Wendy. You've been hearing the discussion here on the two parcels, the Mite Cove and the Sumdum parcels.
Yes.
The five acre Sumdum, the questions of archaeological or historic value, and those has the university looked at those at that 5 acre parcel, and is there? I guess I'm trying to figure out what kind of development the university could proceed with on that a parcel with that kind of history if the university received that parcel.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'm going to defer to Mary Montgomery, who is our land manager, on that question. I think if a flag has been planted as an archaeological site, which is very, very easy to do, I might add, then not much is going to happen with it.
Okay, thank you, Wendy. And if Mary, would you identify yourself on the record and let us know what you know of that particular site and the historical and cultural situation there.
Yes, my name is Mary Montgomery. I'm the director of the University of Alaska Land Management Office. As to development plans for these parcels, we don't have any specific development plans for any of the parcels. It's been a long process of going through legislative hearings and grants and conveyances, and we really just haven't gone out to the properties to determine what their potential is at this point. If the property has archaeological resources, they're protected under state law, and we would never destroy those archaeological resources. The Sumdum parcel specifically, Sea Alaska has shown an interest in. They would like to acquire the property for native, historic, cultural preservation reasons. But we haven't made any commitment for that. There's been some interest, from others that would want to acquire it, but we just haven't made any decisions. If we got the property, what we would do with it, I would assume our academic people would certainly want, if there are high-value archaeological resources, our academic people would be interested in preserving the property in university ownership so that they could study it. But we just haven't gotten that far.
Okay, fine, and the committee needs to recognize this does have two other committee referral in the House, so that we can also request that the university look at certain things and so that they have the information at the time. Representative Gardner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I guess these questions are probably for Mary Montgomery. Do we know what it costs the university annually to manage its land office? And then how much revenue does the management provide the university on an average annual basis?
Well, this is Mary Montgomery again.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Our budget is generally around $2.5 million a year, $2.5 million for the cost of operating the land management office. We, just to clarify, though, we have a much larger mission than managing investment lands and developing real estate for the university. We also do all the educational property projects That means we have over 1 million acres of other people's land that our academic people use for research purposes. So our office secures all those permits and leases so that our academic people can do their research. We do all the educational property acquisitions, disposals. We do space leasing. So we do a number of things beyond just investment type activities. And we generate, on average, usually somewhere around $10 million. We've had years up to $16 million. We've had years down to $5 million. When we first started out, we didn't generate as much money as we do now. So it's been a progression of increasing our income.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there any other testimony on either of these two parcels, Mike Cove or Sundum? Yes, we have one. Would you come forward? And if you testified before, we want to make sure we don't get repeats. If you have additional testimony, go ahead and add that this time. And would you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Chairman Seaton, committee members. My name is Norm Carson. When I testified here earlier this week, I testified as an individual. Since then, I have contacted my board. I'm president of our Chamber of Commerce in Pelican, and they have they support my earlier testimony. And also, I'd point out that Deb Spencer and her business is a member of our chamber. And as a board, as president, I can say we would support her testimony that she gave earlier. Since I made my last comments, I've had a chance to listen to the testimony, and I heard some good questions the other day that I'd just like to answer. One was, is why does Pelican want university land closer to our town, whereas other communities want land away from their town? They don't want land taken closer to their town. Well, my answer is we're all different. We have different attitudes towards development. We have different economies. In Pelican, we are, because of our cold storage issue, it's not operating, we might be a little bit more pro-development now. And so we would like to see land selected closer to our town. And there is a solution here. There is DNR land within 2 miles of our community versus the 13 miles away that my Cove parcel is. This land is designated for settlement, whereas the Mike Cove is designated for recreational. So instead of doing an end run around the public process and taking recreational land and now transferring it to the university, which then could become settlement land, why it just makes sense we could do this 235-acre parcel within closer to Pelican. It's already zoned, or it's already designated for settlement. It would benefit our community. I go by that parcel. I live 3 miles from Pelican. Every day I go to town, I now have neighbors. The selection of that property would make it more probable that as the city looks towards expansion, that we would become annexed and we would become part of that city. We would be part of a community. It's going to be a long time before development ever goes 13 miles out towards Cross Sound. And that's, as you've heard before, that's where we take people to recreate. That's where I'm in the tourism business. I take people out there to look at it. But that's a different testimony.
Thank you. And Mr. Miles, we'll have you come up and address that in a moment.
And that's basically what I wanted to say.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else on these two parcels? Mr. Miles, would you return to the mic? It's interesting when we have a community that's asking for the, instead of opposing, but asking for a change in areas. Is that, has the division looked at that potential?
excuse me, Representative Seaton, through the chair. I think with this legislation, we were hoping not to get into adding parcels or starting into that whole debate. However, with the Pelican one, that was actually on the original lands list. and I think it was taken off because of community objections 5 years ago. So I guess, you know, with that one, since it's already been through the process before it, we know we could look at that again. I'd have to talk to the university and such, I think, but we could certainly look at the Pelican area again.
Okay, and it sounds like that might even be of higher value, more to the university. But it was through the process. Did that have a number on
there? It's parcel ST1002. I think they're referring to part of that parcel. I'm assuming that's the same parcel. I could talk to the gentleman here and confirm what lands they're talking
okay.
about exactly.
If you wouldn't mind doing that, you know, we're just going to be on this bill till 9, and then we're going to other issues. So, but we can look at it next week. But it sounds like they're, and it'd be nice to get some solutions moving along here as well. And thank you very much. And you will, I'm sure, engage Ms. Montgomery and Redmond from the university in that discussion with that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do we have any Carol Karnes?
Yes.
Are you online? Would you go ahead? We are running close on time for this bill, but would you go ahead with your testimony, please?
Yes. My name is Carol Karnes.
Karen.
And I'm representing the Tongass Conservation Society.
Okay, very good. And if you have written testimony, we'd appreciate you submitting that as well.
Okay. I'm just giving spoken testimony today.
Okay, that's fine.
I'm speaking for our members and to let you know that we have considerable concerns about this approach to funding of higher education in the state of Alaska. We have some doubts about the claim that this program contributes significantly to the university's budget. We've had some serious problems with the way that the land was disposed of in Ketchikan. In particular, land that was adjacent to private property, residential homes, was sold for $1,200 an acre, and it was never advertised in the local area. So the local residents who would have liked to have bought land that was adjacent to their property were not given that opportunity. And the land was then immediately clear cut. And we don't think that the university or the local area had much benefit from the selling of this land. The selections in this area right now that we're looking at over in Mosier Bay, there are people that live over there, the other areas on the Cleveland Peninsula, and in Lease Cove, there's not really much opportunity, particularly on the Cleveland, for development in those areas that would significantly contribute to the Ketchikan area. Now, we want to make it clear that we don't have any objection and think that the university should be using its land for academic purposes, and we would like to see more of that going on, but we think that there's considerable concern, and that is one of the reasons why we brought our suit initially, because that this concept of funding higher education is not an appropriate one for Alaska. We don't think that that's really the main purpose of the way the program has been run, that it only contributes a small percentage to the university's budget, and that I've been told by people, oh, this is going to go forward, and that the only way to address it is by the individual parcels, and people are certainly doing that in the testimony that I've heard. They're talking about the way that particular parcels are being designated for these sales. But I think that also, if this goes forward and there are pieces that are sold, that the way that this land is sold is something that really needs to be public, for one thing. It needs to be very much out there so that people know what's happening to the land around them, so that they're not sneaked up on, which is the way that the people here felt when the land right next door to them was sold for $1,200 an acre to a company that came in and devalued their property, caused their property values to go down because of what was done in property that was adjacent to theirs.
Well, thank
but
you.
But the main purpose that we're here to speak about today is that we do not feel that this is an appropriate way for funding the university and that it should be reconsidered.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Don't see any questions, and we will put this bill aside, and we will look at it again next week. Thank you for the people that testified, and we will now take up House Bill 317. We're going to take just a moment at ease. Education. We have before us House Bill 317. We have my aide Katie Kester is going to come up and we had an amendment, I believe. Ms. Kester, would you go ahead and identify yourself on the record and then proceed.
Katie Kester, staff to Representative Seaton. Just like to briefly speak to the amendment before you, E2 in the upper right-hand corner. What this amendment does is it replicates the 1.5% increase in block funding for the fiscal year 2012. If you'll recall, in House Bill 317, we increase funding for the base student allocation by $125 for the next three fiscal years, and also for also increase for the first fiscal year the funding for block grants. This would just take that increase and extend it by an additional year. That would make the first year being a 1.5% increase and the second year a 3% increase. So if you'll see the actual amendment inserts a section 3 on page 2 following 9 line that mimics the section preceding it with just a different factor in there. Instead of 1.215, it's 1.23. And then all the other changes are changes to section numbers that the bill is referring to, because you have to renumber quite a few sections because of the different effective dates of the different pieces of this legislation.
Okay, so are there any questions? We had talked before about the increase of 1.5% on the block grant for, you know, trying to promote career technical and vocational education, and this puts that same additional 1.5% on the second year of the bill.
No.
Representative Wilson.
Okay.
So it would, just one further explanation. So the block grant would increase from 20 to 21.5% in the first year, and would increase to 23% in the second year and subsequent years.
Okay.
Representative Wilson.
I think that explained.
Okay.
My question.
Thank you. Are there other questions on amendment? And I would like to label this 26LS1378 / E.2 as amendment number one. I would move amendment number one. Is there objections? I forgot to do that earlier. Okay, so we have amendment number one. Seeing no objection, amendment number one is adopted. And for for the public and procedures, we are looking at amendments today so that we can post them on our website as a complete bill so that the public can look at the entire bill as is being amended and being proposed, and they can then make comments on those. One of the problems is that in our system, the committee substitute doesn't get posted on basis until after it's moved from committee, and therefore it's difficult because we keep getting comments on the old bill, that's old parts of the bill that are no longer under consideration. So just for public explanation, we're not intending to move this bill today, but we want to get amendments rolled in. Representative Book.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. So we'll see the final version and look towards moving this bill midweek?
That's correct.
Thank you, sir.
Mid next week, yes.
Yeah.
And I have a conceptual amendment that I would like to add, and that is this bill was, let me go back, the discussion before I offer the amendment. I'll offer the amendment first to have our procedure.
Yeah, right.
Okay, and the amendment is to remove the third year of the forward funding. And thank you for the objection. And the reason for this is that when the task force originally came forward and the legislature approved forward funding, they did a three-year cycle, but that brought us into needing to accomplish review of this and to extend it in the second session of this legislature. And if we did a three-year extension, it would mean that after there is a new legislature formed, you know, 3 years from now, during the first session with a new committee in both the House and the Senate, they would have to understand the funding formula, understanding the needs of the districts, understanding those things, and come forward with a bill and pass it in the first session of the legislature, which would be extremely difficult. And so what this does, it puts it into so that you have a committee that forms, committee goes through their overviews, tries to understand as best we can all the ramifications, the education, and can then come forward in the second session of their legislature passing a forward funding bill, which would then give ample time. So the amendment is to change this bill and just knock off the third year of the forward funding portion. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You and I spoke briefly about this. We could also add a fourth year, and then they're in the second year and they can amend it anywhere along the process, but they don't have the urgency that a three-year formula gives them. And the districts know that the fourth year is out there if things drag.
Responding to that question, it's looking 4 years out and trying to put in base student allocation numbers and the block grant and understanding what all the other formula funding mix I'm hard-pressed to do. So I think that we'll have a lot easier time of being able to explain the forward funding and why we need certain pieces when they're not so far in the distance that we will have a hard time explaining what would the consumer price index be, what has happened in education, what has happened in the economy. 4 years is getting to be a long time away. So that's my reasoning for going to 2 years instead of saying two future legislatures. And not only that, it gets the forward funding mechanism and the idea of that so that the legislature, two future legislatures, would be a lot to maintain the historical knowledge of what's going forward. I actually think it's better that it's considered more recently so we have the historical knowledge in the legislature of the forward funding mechanism and how we got it there. That's my discussion on you've objected. I'm saying why I think 2 years is, from my standpoint.
I'm thinking.
Okay, that's fine. Is there any further discussion on the amendment? It's up for discussion. And that is a conceptual amendment, which whatever we do will be rolled into the CS and they'll be available for the public to view. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I recognize that if I were to succeed in a proposal to extend it for 4 years rather than reduce it to two, as you propose, that it would probably be modified in the Finance Committee. You know, that's probably the truth. But we're the Education Committee, and when we're talking about letting school districts plan, even knowing that things can change, that nothing is in stone, that the money's not there until it's actually there, I still think it's better to have a plan further out, knowing that it can be modified, which is the case indeed right now. I mean, things we could come in next year and modify it at the beginning of the year if circumstances warranted and the body at that time wanted to do so. So, Mr. Chair, I would offer an amendment to your conceptual amendment and increase it a year rather than bring it back a year.
That amendment is, and I'll object to the amendment, to the amendment. And I have a very hard time visualizing what we're going to do for those if we're going to put in $100, $125 4 years from now. I think it's going to be difficult to move that through the legislative process, and I think that, you know, 2 years overcomes the hurdle of the first session necessity to necessary understand and act, but doesn't get us the drag of having to come up with a number for 4 years from now, and I would hope that we would make these numbers, although anything is modifiable, I would hope that we can define them enough as we did in the last, that we're not anticipating them being meaningless and anticipating modification. I hope that we don't just put a marker out there and say, I mean, I hope that we're actually saying that school districts should be able to count on us to be meaningfully saying this is it, not it may be something. So that's why my objection, because I don't know what that number would be right now for 4 years from now.
Okay.
Do you want to maintain your
I do.
Okay, the amendment is to change the number of years to four instead of two. We'll have a vote.
Vote of Amendment 3 to Amendment Number 2. Representative Munoz is absent. Representative Wilson?
Pass.
Representative Edgman is absent. Representative Keller is absent. Representative Book?
No.
Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Chair Seaton?
No.
I have one yay, two nays.
It's a tie, it fails, right?
Tie, it fails.
I'm sorry. Representative Wilson? On a pass.
Yes.
So amendment amendment to the amendment fails. Now we have the amendment before us. Is there objection to
I'll remove my objection.
Objection is removed. We have is there any further objection? Seeing none. Representative Book, are you objecting to the amendment?
No.
Okay. So amendment number two, making forward funding for 2 years has been adopted, and for this conceptual amendment, what we're doing is just dropping off the third year. It's not a modification of either of the first 2 years. It's only a dropping off the third year. Representative Book.
Recognizing that the decision has been made and also recognizing that this isn't the final committee on this, I would anticipate several changes taking place prior to this being even going to the Senate side. So these discussions here, I think, are very mind-provoking and substantive and are going to be changed. So I'm looking for the evolution of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any further amendments for HB 317 to come before the committee? Seeing none, we have adopted two amendments today. We'll incorporate those into a CS, post them on the website, and looking at moving this bill next week. Let's see. Oh, we do have people to testify, and public hearing is still open. We have Norm Carson. Oh, that was the wrong one. Carl Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Carl Rose, Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. Just a couple comments. I like the conceptual amendment that just failed, and considering my retirement at some point in time, if we could extend that to 10 years, I'd appreciate that. Mr. Chairman, Association of Alaska School Boards appreciates House Bill 317 as amended. I'm going to keep my comments brief. This idea that was crafted by the task force on school funding and what it produced in terms of a forward funding concept was extremely valuable to school districts. I've heard most of the conversation here, and I appreciate you holding this bill over. We will be in town this weekend. You'll be addressing us. I believe it's Tuesday morning. And I think my association will be in full support of this bill as amended. We are concerned with the future. And when we look at this conceptual amendment to come back to 2 years, it does make sense that the people who will be dealing with the either reauthorization or extension of such an effort be at least in the second session. I think I understand that. And we do have an uncertain future to some extent. We appreciate that. I think that the idea of addressing the block grant has been something we've been after for some time, and I do appreciate that. So AASB supports the bill as amended, and we're looking forward to offering more testimony, and you are visiting with us on Tuesday. So we'll be back on Wednesday to share more with you then. So thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Great. Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Rose? Thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Murray Irvin, did you? Thank you. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 317 at this time? Is there anyone online? No. We do have one other thing to talk about on House Bill 317 before we set it aside. And we brought this up the other day, and that was the Military and Youth Academy and how that worked in, as well as the residential facilities. And Mr. Jeans has prepared, in response to our question, sheet and some tables. Mr. Jeans, would you come forward? And that's labeled Department of Education and Early Development School Finance Response to House Questions 2010.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance and Facilities for the Department of Education. And actually, Mr. Chairman, this document addresses I believe it was four different questions that the committee asked in response to House Bill 317. The first one was that the committee wanted to know how the funding compared between the various residential programs. And so you'll see on page two, we've listed out the various programs. You'll see the top one's Galena, the second one, Lower Kuskokwim, Nenana, Mount Edgecombe, and then lastly, the Alaska Military Youth Academy. The dollars represented here are the dollars that are generated through the foundation program for those students, as well as any residential funding that's provided for those students. You may recall a couple years ago, the legislature passed a residential funding program for the areas Galena, Lower Kuskokwim, and Nenana. Mount Edgecombe's residential component is funded through the department's operating budget. And then we divided the total revenues by the number of students to give you an idea of how much money is currently being allocated for the various programs. You also asked about the Military Youth Academy program itself, how it operates. We contacted the academy and understand that they are running 22-week residential sessions a year. You may recall in the Military Youth Academy's funding, there's one calculation that is seven times the base student allocation, and that's the one that provides for the residential as well as the instructional program. And then there's a second allocation in that program, and I'd have to look it up, but it's a quite smaller adjustment that is for continuing to track those students after they've left the program and they are provided mentors and follow-up. The next question that the committee asked was about, or maybe it was you, Mr. Chairman, about the pupil transportation adjustments for the CPI. And what we found is many of the contracts do have language that allow for upward or downward adjustment. I would say that we would still support your amendment or your proposed language, and mainly that's due to the pupil transportation program is tied to, it's a grant now based on the number of students. So even if you have a declining student population, you still have to run the same number of routes. You know, losing a couple kids on a route isn't going to mean you don't run it anymore, but you would be receiving less state funding to support that program. So I still think that the amendment is a good amendment.
Jim, thank you.
And the last, Mr. Chairman, we had a little discussion about the adjustment of the 1.5%. You made it very clear in your last meeting that this adjustment was intended to provide additional support for those career and tech programs. And so I went back and I looked at how we provided funding for career and voc ed back in 1998 when we had categorical funding. And the amount that was allocated for vocational education back at that in that time was roughly $8.5 million. And the total foundation program was running $795 million. So that represented about 1.08% of the total funding was categorically identified for voc-ed. Now, even back then, those dollars were intended for the additional cost of vocational programs, not the base cost of those programs. So adding the 1.5%, you can see clearly identifies roughly 1.07% of the total, or $14 million out of almost $4 billion. And then when you move it to to the 23%, the additional 3%, excuse me, that would provide approximately almost $30 million out of a $1.4 billion budget would represent about 2%. So I think that's a pretty good move in the right direction. And as long as people continue to understand that these are dollars for the additional cost of running those programs on top of what they are currently providing, I think that's a good move in the right direction.
Good. And I would like to get concurrence of the committee that we write a letter of intent that goes along with this bill that specifies that that's our intention of this, is that the career technical vocational education component is here, but this is not supplanting the current use, current base support in the block grant. And so I think it would be beneficial if we actually put that in as a letter of intent that goes along with the bill. Does anybody have any objection to that?
No.
Seeing no objection, we'll have that available at this at our when the bill and CS is done. Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eddie, what's your title? Director?
Through the chair, I'm the Director of School Finance and Facilities.
In giving you your due respect, Director, I'd like to step back. I really appreciate you coming forth with some of these this information. Interesting, of the four examples that you have out here, the one for Mount Edgecombe is now in the operating budget. Did I hear you correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Book, that's correct.
Hmm. The fear that we've been hearing over and over and over and over and over and over and over again throughout the discourse, especially this session, is the loss of federal funds and the ability to maintain some of the intended improvements that we're trying to make. Do you foresee that the other three eventually would be picked up on the same, in the same perspective?
Through the chair, Representative Book, that's a tough one to answer, because Mount Edgecombe is a state-operated school. It's state-owned and operated, and that's why the residential component shows up in the department's budget. If at some point in the future, say, for instance, Galena wanted to contract with the state to operate another state-operated school, I could see where there could be amendments made to our budget to include their residential component in the Department of Education's budget as a contracted school. But as it stands right now, the legislature did pass a funding mechanism a couple years ago. I forget the name of the number of the bill, but you do provide residential funding for Galena, Lower Kuskokwim, Nenana, as a separate component outside the foundation program. And so I think you're addressing the need that wasn't there before, but they have their own formula. So it's still in our budget. It's not operating funds, not part of the department's operating budget, but it's part of our grant budget.
Representative Book, follow up.
One of the things that the Alaska Military Youth Academy does is track post-graduation so that they know where these kids have gone and what the adults have become. And that's a huge asset, so that they actually know they can gauge their success. And that's one of the things that this committee has been after since the onset. How do we assess what we're doing? And this, to me, seems like a very proficient way of doing that. So what I'm encouraging is to use this example as a model when we go forward with some of these other opportunities for kids, so that we can find out what we're doing. And I'm encouraged by the fact that it doesn't look like that's much of a fiscal note, and that that component really adds to the validity of what we're doing. So if that, as an example, could be encouraged in the way that we proceed with especially these kinds of opportunities, I would encourage that, and would hope that the department would also see ways of encouraging that in the various opportunities these kids have throughout the rest of the state. So I think it's a tractable mechanism. That's all I'm trying to say. Thank you.
Mr. Union, did you have a comment on?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Book, you're correct. That component that the Military Youth Academy receives is about $890,000 a year to provide mentoring and to continue to track those students' progress. I think you're going to see probably not as detailed mentoring provided, but through the cooperative agreements that the department is entering into with the university system and Department of Labor, I think you're going to see more and more of that tracking what's happening to students, especially when they stay in the state of Alaska. And as long as all of our agencies can maybe utilize the benefit of having a unique student identifier, that would help us even more. So I know that we're having those discussions and hopefully moving in that direction.
And following up on that point, I think that we either went out yesterday or it'll go out today, a article on another state that has done the unique identifier and is not just has been able to expand it beyond the use within their state to tracking those students throughout the United States. So there may be mechanisms already that are developed for those students. I think it was Arizona, but it could have been New Mexico or something. Or Mr. Jean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might add, we're already using it in other areas. So for instance, with the pilot pre-K program, we required all those programs to utilize the department's student ID system so that we can track the progress of those students and be able to do some real analysis in the future as to the benefits of expanding that that course offerings down to pre-K. So,
and I think that the committee was very pushy on making sure that we would be able to track those things because we wanted to be able to have that follow-up.
Right.
To find out what we're doing. Representative Book.
Follow up on your question or your comment is this, that we still have some obvious corrections to make. When someone homeschools their child, all of that stuff disappears. It's as if it never happened. So I'm still here trying to figure out ways that we can correct that and have a tracking mechanism on those people. They come back into the system in some of the mechanisms of the Military Youth Academy. Right. And from that point on, they're tracked. But that's the only one that I know where people fall off the rolls and they come back on. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Jeans, you know, we're touching on a point here that has been a very strong interest of the committee to be able to follow through and see results of programs. And if there's anything that we need to do in statute that has been preventing the department from moving forward on any things, we would like to request that you let us know those things.
Yeah.
And then the committee can take it up as far as whether we want to do it. But unless we know that we have a roadblock someplace or that we have a student identifier that's not required in a program or something like that, if we don't have that knowledge, we can't address it. So we'd appreciate the department sharing with us any roadblocks that they're seeing in being able to longitudinally track that for research purposes. Representative Gardner.
I have a question for you, Mr. Chair.
I
can wait if you want to finish with Mr. Jeans.
I guess what I want to do is on one of the sheet, the second sheet that Mr. Jeans provided, which was the details of the different residential programs. One of the reasons we brought this up with the Alaska Military Youth Academy, with the way we're calculating that now and the increases in the formula that we have built in, we have an escalator of 7 times, and we had obviously at 27,756. What we did was we built in at one time in the past a base amount that was needed for this special program, but as we have escalated the base student allocation through forward funding and legislative action, we haven't really recognized that increase isn't probably 7 times from that base amount necessary to conduct that program. And so I think that we need to look at the funding mechanism we're using for the Alaska Military Youth Academy. There is no one that I know on this committee that doesn't see that as a valuable program. However, where we have a multiplier being the funding mechanism that may not correspond at all with the needs of that program. So I'm not sure, Mr. Jeans, if we wanted to change that funding program so it wasn't didn't have that same kind of unintended consequence in incrementals, would HB 317 be where we would do that, or would that be another mechanism which would be best to accomplish that?
Mr. Chairman, I'd recommend that you do it through another bill, and I would also recommend that you have Military Youth Academy come before you and explain their program and their needs. Basically, the department is simply a flow-through agency. We calculate the aid and we allocate the money.
Sure, and I was not at all thinking that we would take any action on this without having them here, just for everybody's knowledge. But I was just wondering, so that's good. So we'll be looking at, I think I'd like to follow that suggestion of not hold this bill up or complicate the 317 with this issue. But I think that we need to raise the issue for the legislature, and so that the legislature can consider this, because I think it's an unintended consequence of the way we'd constructed a previous funding mechanism. So I think that we will probably, within the next 2 weeks, we'll have the, if they're available, we'll have the Alaska Military Youth Program here and look at that. And again, I just want to make sure that everybody understands that at least the chairman is not in opposition to that program. We just want to make sure that the mechanism that we have for funding that program is the appropriate mechanism. So let's see, we had Representative Gardner, did you have a?
Yes, if you're ready for a new topic.
Yes, I am.
Well, before we get off that.
Okay, on the point we're on, Representative Boop.
When you request those folks to come here, I would like to make a special request on that we have the recruiting officer as well. He's very crucial in these concerns and these discussions.
Very good, and if you'd get with my staffer on that, we'll make sure that he's invited at the same time. Representative Wilson, on this point.
Yes, on that point, I'm trying to remember because I've been in committee when they've been here before, and my memory could be wrong on this, but it seems to me that there was a difference with the other schools, because the other schools had kids there full 9 months, but they had each group of kids for 3 months, and then they got them, I'm not sure if my memory is right on that, which would make it a total of 6 months instead of 9 months. But I don't know if that's, if my memory is being good to me or not.
Thank you, and I think that question number two was there's two 22-week, so the program is 22 weeks now. And
so that's 5 months.
Yeah, 5 months.
Oh, so they go year-round?
They just cycle. Mr. Right. Jeans, do you know how that is? That's one program is 22 weeks, and those students are then out of that program, and there's a new group of students, or is it?
That's my understanding, Mr. Chairman.
And we'll have them here to explain that and full program. On this point, still on the Alaska Military Youth Academy, Representative Boop?
Yes. What they do is they have these two cycles. They go through a cycle. Their staff gets more training in the interim, and then they start another cycle. So this is just a continuing loop of students that process through there, and they're actually taking more students in all the time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. And so that will be on a future schedule for us. Is there anything else on House Bill 317 or on funding? Yes, Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, just before you introduce this bill, you came and spoke with each of us and asked us, told us what you thought the impact would be. And I told you that I would check with Anchorage School District and see if they had a preference between an increase of a BSA $200 increase or breaking it into the block grant and the lower BSA. And I did do that, and we have before us their analysis, which is actually an email from Carol Como forwarding, email from Janet Stokesbury, who is the CFO, maybe that's the title. And my question is this, with the passage of Amendment Number 1 today, her analysis will change somewhat. Will you be asking for her to update this, or shall I do that?
We will, I presume that this is something that all these districts have been looking at very carefully, and they're probably listening today, I would hope. But we will solicit from the districts the information on the new revised bill.
Okay, because ASD currently thinks a $200 BSA increase is preferable to the way we've done it, but now that may change their analysis. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay, we'll put House Bill 317 aside. We will have the CS drafted to incorporate the changes, post it on our website, and look forward to comments for that. We now have House Bill 206 for us. And we'll take a brief at ease. Bring this meeting of House Education back to order. If there's private conversations, would you take them in the hall? And we are on House Bill 206. And we have a CS that is 26LS0765/P before us. And so I will move that we adopt that CS, that's version P, as a working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you. And we have that before us. And Mr. Flora, would you come address the bill for us?
Hi, I'm Louis Flora, committee aide to Representative Seaton. And the P version is the most recent version, replacing the version I just saw here, which was the S version, I believe.
Yes.
From 42209, and the changes to on the P version begin on page 2, line 27, and that essentially replaces the provision in the S version that dealt with the student count averaging of the two different student counts, one in February and one in October and one again in February. And so that language was deleted, and we replaced it with a new section 2 that extends the existing 20-day student count period to an 80-day student count period ending the second Friday in February. And then if you go on to page 3, section 4, beginning on line 22, you'll notice that the funding for the school year is based on the count for the preceding fiscal year. So the intent is the funding or the count from the past year will fund the current year. And then the section 5 on page 4, beginning line 2, deals with the adjustment for the, if there is a higher, if there districts report higher student numbers in the existing year, that is the true up. They can increase their funding based on those higher numbers. Sorry, I missed one provision here I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of. In Section 3, we inserted, and that's on page 3, line 17, subsection 3, that makes it explicit, the student count conducted for the immediately preceding school year shall be used for calculating state aid. And then D, if there were early graduates, students that graduated at Christmas or at the end of the first semester of school or the first part of the school year, if they graduated then, they would still be considered for that full 80-day count period. And so that language is just a student who is enrolled and graduates from secondary school during the counting period shall be included in the student count for the full counting period. And for further discussion, I believe Eddie Jeans is available, and I can take questions on the structure of this, but probably be best suited to.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any questions for you, Mr. Flora. Thank you for introducing that. And Mr. Jeans, would you? So, Mr. Jeans, we had had a number of comments from people looking at the two student count periods and averagings and trying to figure out that. And I believe this was a departmental suggestion that if we started in February, in that second week in February, I think it was, put our end date and then go back 80 school days, that would take us to approximately the count, the current start of the current count period. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and I believe the suggestion to go with the continuous count period came from the commissioner, conversation you had with the commissioner.
And this takes a lot of mathematical problems out of the understanding. Also, this bill then would mean that districts, as I'm understanding, would know what their basic funding would be, because it would be funded on the previous year. And then if they have increases throughout that student count period, they would have actually incurred expenses educating more students. Then there would be an adjustment so that they would receive that increase for the actual count of that year. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. As the bill is currently written, funding would be based on the prior year account that establishes a base, a guaranteed funding level. And then if the districts had an increase in student count in the current year, they would receive the benefit of that increased count in the current year.
Okay. And I think that that addresses a number of the comments that we received from school districts as well, as to trying to figure out averages and all. And I'd just like to draw the public's attention, as well as the committee's, the philosophy behind this extended count was that if you have a count at the beginning of the year and after that 20 days, although we are not saying that all the districts function this way, but there's not really an economic incentive to keep students engaged in school and keep them in school for the second semester. They've still got paid for the full year. We've been looking at a number of things like extending mandatory compulsory education age, and yet we found that more than half of the students in school drop out when they're under 16. From that longitudinal study from Anchorage. And so if that's happening, the districts aren't putting a lot of truancy, they're not putting a lot, I shouldn't say they're not putting in a lot of effort, they're not putting, somehow they're not keeping those kids in school, the dropouts. And so this is going to give them a financial incentive, a count incentive, to maintain students in school after the Christmas break, and make sure that they come back and reestablish in the second semester. And so that has been the purpose of this, is to make sure that we're aligning the incentives to what we want to see accomplished, and that is student engagement and student retention in school. And the reason for Section 3 was that we could have a perverse incentive of saying we wouldn't let students graduate early, because then you would lose them during that part of the count period. So this is to make sure that we don't have that. If anyone sees any other incentives that aren't directed at the activities we want to see, they need to let us know that. We've had a number of comments. First of all, does anybody else have any other comments on the bill, the CS that we have? Representative Gardner?
Thank you. I'm not sure I understand really a rationale for having an 80-day count period instead of two count periods.
I guess we could answer from the comments that we got back and the averaging and just the mathematical going back and forth, and there was some question within the all those comments and emails, and people didn't understand, and we were having to draw flow charts to decide when what's averaged when and which carried forward, and so the commissioner thought that it was just they're already collecting this data, and it was a lot easier to establish a longer count period and have it the actual actual average of when you're doing students. And so this was an accommodation to just the functioning of mathematical how we did the counts. And there was some concern that the February period was when some people were, that specific period, were going to be gone for either vacation reasons or this reason or that reason, and so it magnified that particular window of the count. And
doing March.
I understand, but we didn't. If there's some advantage of having two separate count periods over a continuous count, that hasn't come to us. But if you would like to put that forward, that's fine. Representative Gardner.
Well, it seems to me that if you're really trying to identify the number of students that are lost to the school, if you will, from the beginning count period, the later in the year that you do it, the more accurately you're measuring what the attrition has been. And doing it in one steady period for 80 days, that's, you know, 2.5 months, doesn't seem to me to get to the heart of it. If you, you know, why wouldn't you count October and count again in April? And what I heard the argument is, well, people have gone to fish camp or people have gone on vacation or whatever, but that's the whole point. They're not in school anymore. And that's what we want to identify and know what those numbers are and build in an incentive for districts and administration to kind of stay on top of it and pull out all the stops to try to prevent that attrition. That's our goal. I think we're watering it down already right here.
Representative Wilson on this point?
Yes.
Okay.
The reason to me is because the school districts start making their budget deliberations, and they have to have, and they start sending out pink slips. They have to do that pretty early, and so this will help them know exactly what the facts are, so when they do their budget deliberations or when they look to see about those pink slips, that they don't have to do that.
Mr. Chair, that's kind of mixing apples and oranges. The purpose of having two count periods is to simply, number one, get a realistic idea of what the attrition is over the course of a school year, and secondly, build in an incentive that will kind of encourage districts. I'm not saying that classroom teachers aren't already invested in keeping their kids, but to really focus on addressing that problem so the two numbers don't change very much.
Mr. Jeans, can you address this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gardner, I want to say you're getting what you were looking for in the beginning with this amendment. In the previous proposal, we had two count periods that were 20-day count periods, one in October, one in February. What was confusing people was the averaging of the two count periods for funding purposes. What we've done with this recommendation is said, take the existing methodology of the count and extend it for 80 days and get out into February, just like you were going to do with the two counts. So you're still capturing the student enrollment in the periods that you were looking for under the two count periods. What we've done is we've eliminated the averaging of the two count periods, which was really confusing to people how that mechanism worked. We are achieving the same desire that you had in the previous bill too, by providing the base funding based on the prior year count. So it provides districts with a guarantee of how much money they're going to get based on how many kids they had last year. And if I have more kids this year, then I get the benefit of that increased count. The other piece is we have to stop sometime during the year so the department can do a reconciliation for the current year. And that's why we reached out to mid-February. That gives us an opportunity to collect all that student data, do the reconciliations, make sure we're not paying for the same kid twice, and make those financial adjustments to the school districts in the current year.
And Representative Gardner, I just want to point out that in the previous version of the bill, we had the February count period. Right. So we're not going from April count period back to a February. We did a February because the reports had to be in March. And so the end of the count period is still going to be the same.
Mr. Chair, I'm not a happy camper. I think we're backtracking from our initial, intent of what I understood and what my personal goal in this was. I think we're already diluting it.
But you do realize that the two bills, the previous bill was a February count period, and we're still going to the same date in the count period. So we've got as an extended account period as we had before. It's just the mathematical.
If I may, Representative Gardner, I think you're actually strengthening your original intent, because under the previous bill, you had two 20-day count periods. One of the criticisms is after the current 20-day count period, some districts have lost interest in some children. Well, having two separate 20-day count periods, you could say that kind of activity could happen again. What you've done is you've had a continuous 80-day count period now. Districts are going to do whatever they can to keep kids enrolled during that full 80 days to maximize the funding. So you're not going to have that game plan that was perceived under the current 20-day count period, or potentially under two 20-day count periods.
Representative Gardner.
And what happens on day 81 or day 120? That's my concern. How would those numbers compare? We'll never know, really.
And through the chair, Representative Gardner, you would not have known that under the previous proposal with the two 20-day counts averaged. The only way that we could ever get to what you're getting at is to go to a full 180-day count period during the current year, and that would be your funding for the subsequent year. And that would not allow the department an opportunity to adjust in the current year when districts have increased student enrollments.
Thank you.
Are there other questions on this segment? There was one. We've had a number of comments about schools and small schools. The way that this works, basing the count on the previous year, and I know it addresses districts, does this, in the formula, or where it comes in the formula, does that address that problem at all of a school of 10 or 11, and then what would happen subsequently, or does it affect at all the small schools and them being able to get their count up?
Mr. Chairman, that's a really good question, and my response to that is those communities that have been playing games with the minimum of 10 students for a 20-day count period are going to have more difficulty playing that game, because they're going to have to keep those kids for 80 days now. And you're absolutely right. If you have 10 students for the full 80 days in the prior year, you get that benefit for the subsequent year. The funding does not go directly to the school for 10 kids. It goes to the district. The district determines how to allocate those resources. But as I mentioned, if you had 10 students in the prior year and in the current year you can't maintain those 10, you're still getting funding on that prior year account to get you through that transition year.
Great. And I think that is something that will help reconcile some of the questions that we've had from some of the smaller schools. Thank you. Is there anything else that we want to discuss on this? Representative Book, do you still maintain your objection to the adoption of P version?
Or? I do not.
Okay, that objection is removed. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, we have adopted the P version, and we will post that on our website so that will be available to districts. And we do have a couple of people to testify on this bill. We're going to have to be quick. We're over time. Darlene Trippett, are you there? Oh, you're here. Welcome, and would you identify yourself on the record and proceed, and realize that we do have I think you've heard the discussion of the new version of the bill we have before us.
Okay. I was thinking I was testifying on the high school exit exam.
Oh, no, we don't have that before.
But I do have comments on the 80-day count. I'm Darlene Triplett, and I am from Dillingham City Schools. And I know the 20-day count. The only thing that I can speak to as far as 20-day count, small districts such as ours, the superintendent such as myself has to get involved with the 20-day count, and it's hard for the record-keeping part. So maybe if you could extend when at the end, when you only have a couple weeks to turn your report in, because we did in the 20-day count, I had about 20 students that I have to figure out. They were dual counted in other districts, and I have to go through and hand tally some of that information. Small sites don't always have a staff member that does the technological part of all of this. So if I could speak to that part of it and maybe just get an extension on when those numbers are due, that would help our district out. Sometimes the 20 days and trying to, or the 10 days that you get after the count period, isn't long enough to make sure that those numbers are correct, and to check with the other districts to make sure that your count's correct against the days that they've counted their students. So okay. That's the only comment that I have.
Well, thank you, and we'll check with the department and find out what that is. And it was 10 days, which it was very short for you. Right. So
well, I'm thinking the 20 days, 10 days is a long enough period, but now if we've got 80 days, maybe if the State Department can help us along the way with every 20 days coming up with those students that may be getting dual counts in another district, so that it's not wait until the very end and then I have 80 days in which I might have a list of 100 students.
Okay, and I think the department is recognizing the question, and we'll work on that and address it in when the bill comes up again. Thank you for your comment. Woody Wilson, are you online in Wrangell?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. I thank you very much for this opportunity. First of all, I'd like to thank you and your committee for all the hard work that they do for the children of Alaska. I think that's wonderful. On House Bill 206, I do have some concerns, though. My first concern is that it mandates the WorkKeys testing program, and WorkKeys, in my view and in my school board's view and in the view of a lot of other people, is not useful for all students in Alaska. For students that are college bound, it has very little value. I don't know of any universities that require work keys for our entrance. I do know that most universities want to see the SAT or the ACT, and most of them don't know what work keys really is. So for students who are college bound, the requirement seems to be one of just a waste of time and energy, and we think that it would be a good thing for some students. Obviously, if students are going into the world of work, if they're going into a vocational track, if they're going into post-secondary technical school, some counselors in some of those schools understand work keys and understand the value. So there may be some value for some of those students. For other students, we don't see the value. A second issue, it's unclear. In some of the previous literature that came out, it indicated that school districts were going to have to pay for the tuition for the classes that you're suggesting. And I don't see that in the bill. What the bill says is something about the school district will make arrangements for payment. That seems to be unclear. I believe that should be clarified. If the school district is going to pay for the tuition, how much will we pay for tuition? Are there limits on how much we pay? And then there was, in the early literature also, it talked about only in the second semester of the senior year would students be allowed to take college work. We've got quite a history of offering college classes to students in high school in Wrangell. This year we currently offer 51 college credits to our student body. And we've been doing that for a number of years. We probably do more of it than most any other small school in the state of Alaska. There are a number of ways to do this. We do most of our college work with our own teachers that are in Wrangell. We do not take distance classes through the university because we find they're not successful with a lot of students because they're not, our students are still in high school. And they need a little bit more support in terms of making sure that they're being responsible. That doesn't mean that the curriculum is any different. The curriculum is exactly the same. It's all articulated. But there needs to be a little bit more engagement. So we have a lot of experience, and I'm not sure what this is going to do to our program. Are we going to have to... is it going to require us to change our program and offer these courses through the university? Are we going to have to pay tuition? There are just a whole lot of questions about that. And so the idea of the 80-day count, as a superintendent, I have the same frustration that your previous speaker has in terms of the bureaucracy. It makes the bureaucracy much thicker. You will get the results you're looking for, but it's going to be at a significant cost in the public schools, particularly in small schools that don't have IT people that keep track of all this data. And then the reconciliation at the end is going to be a disaster, just like Darlene said. We have to reconcile all these students who are dually enrolled in different school districts, so that's going to take time. I am concerned about the 80-day count. It seems that maybe a 60-day count would be more reasonable because you'd have time after the 60-day count to do this reconciliation. It's just going to be very difficult for, particularly for small schools that don't have IT people to manage that, to get all that done. So I guess in summary then, I'm concerned about the relationship between school districts and the university. I'm concerned about who will pay. For the tuition, I'm concerned that students will be restricted to the second semester, if that's correct, to take their college courses. In some instances, we offer college credit at the junior junior level in high school, in the third year of high school, and that's done particularly in some of the tech prep areas. So the goal is to prevent dropouts. Apparently, that's what you're looking for. It seems to me that we have a model program in Wrangell to offer these classes, and it doesn't require any legislation. So I'm concerned that perhaps there's not an easier way to skin this rabbit that doesn't require any legislation, because we're already apparently doing most of what you're asking for. And I thank you for allowing me to speak to you this morning. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, do we have anybody else in the room to testify? We have anybody online? Seeing none, we will set this bill aside, and we will have it posted. The new CS for both bills will be posted on my website, and we'll ask people to comment on the versions of the bills that are on the website so we get the comments aligned with where our bills are currently, and we will be adjourned at 10:15.